Hello, it's Thursday, May the 6th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. We're going to be talking about the extraordinary Nick Kamen, dead at only 59. I'm going to be talking to the journalist who arranged to meet him and was heartbroken when she never saw him again. The Royals, William and Kate, they've launched their own YouTube channel. They're not doing a bit of one-upmanship, do you think, with the Sussexes? The WalkSafe app, we talked to the founder of that very early on. There are now over 550,000 people who've downloaded it, almost certainly mostly women, to help them feel safer when they're out and about. But first, the extraordinary moment, the Jersey blockade Boris Johnson sends in the Royal Navy. Is he now a modern-day Lord Nelson? So Boris Johnson's dispatched two Royal Navy vessels to patrol waters around Jersey as around 100 French fishing boats protest over post-Brexit fishing rights. The row is simply over new requirements for boats to submit evidence of their past fishing activities, with French authorities claiming the measures are null and void. Number 10 said it sent the two Navy vessels to monitor the situation. The French have sent a naval vessel too. I'm joined now by Senator Ian Gorst, who is Jersey's External Relations Minister. Senator Gorst, thank you for joining us. This is an extraordinary turn of events. Has the Prime Minister overreacted in dispatching two naval vessels?
Well, we've got to set this in the context of a French minister threatening earlier this week to cut off Jersey's electricity. That's electricity that is supplied by a commercial contract via EDF and the Jersey Electricity Company, a totally disproportionate threat in regard to the technical licensing issue, and then French fishing vessels saying that they were going to blockade the main port of the island. Prime Minister was clear last night that he would send the vessels down as a precautionary measure and to monitor the Jersey waters, and I'm pleased to say that the protests today have been peaceful.
How serious was that threat from the French minister, Annick Girardin? She says you've been dragging your feet over the issuing of new licence to French boats, but the threat she issued about effectively cutting underwater cables, bringing your electricity to Jersey, was reminiscent more of Vladimir Putin, you would have thought, than a minister in a French government.
Well, and it was a disproportionate threat, and therefore we had to take it seriously, and we are pleased that we have the full backing of the British government.
Now, where are we now with the French? The French fishermen are insisting, they argue that they've done everything that they're required to do. Who's right in this argument, Senator? Your side is saying that particularly the smaller French vessels haven't filled in the relevant paperwork. They haven't provided the evidence that they've fished there before. So why should you let them return?
Well, the trade deal is quite clear that it respects historic fishing rights. But of course, it's reasonable to be able to prove those historic fishing rights, particularly those vessels with the technology that could do so. And some vessels have provided all of the evidence. The trade deal expects them to provide evidence on nature and extent, and some haven't. They've just provided the minimum amount for 10 days. But don't forget, we've given already a four-month amnesty and a further two-month amnesty for smaller vessels to provide that evidence. So we certainly cannot be accused of dragging our feet. We want to sit down with the EU, who've got some questions about the methodology that we've used, answer those questions, because we've worked with the British government. We believe that the licences that we've issued are appropriate, but we need to deal with those technical issues and not make disproportionate threats like we've seen.
Some of your French fishermen have been quoted, you'll know this, Senator, saying the actions of the French are the equivalent of an act of war.
Well, I, of course, want to move forward and deal with the issues. It is not helpful for people to make those comments or to make those threats or to seek to blockade Jersey's harbour. We will stand up for the island of Jersey and its citizens, and that's exactly as you would expect. But that does not mean that we don't want to sit down with the EU and with French fishermen directly to solve the issues, because we do. And we believe that that's the approach that should have been taken in the first instance.
Do you think there's a lesson learnt here as well for Jersey, Senator? Currently, you depend on France for 95%, I think, of your energy or of your electricity through these undersea cables. Do you think there's now a chance that you may think, perhaps we should diversify our sources of energy?
Oh, no, I don't think so. As I say, it's a commercial contract. It would be unprecedented for a government to step in and interfere with a commercial electricity energy contract in the way that was suggested. But let's remind ourselves that in extremis, we do have a power station and we could be self-sufficient in energy. Having said that, of course, like every other country or island around the world, we are seeking to make sure that we are more self-sufficient in energy requirements, and certain islanders are experimenting with self-generation and all of those things.
Can I ask you just finally, do you think the French government, big proud government that it is, big country that it is, was trying to bully Jersey?
Well, it would appear that that is the case. As I say, those threats were disproportionate to the issue in hand, and we had to take them seriously because of that.
Maybe now we can recast Boris Johnson, who, as you know, is a great admirer of history. We know Winston Churchill is his hero. Perhaps, Senator, we can portray him as Lord Nelson, who, of course, saw off the French at the Battle of Trafalgar.
Well, all I'll say is we've been extremely grateful for his support over the last 48 hours.
Very good. Very good to talk to you, Senator. Fight the good fight, as they say. That's Senator Ian Gorst, who's Jersey's External Relations Minister. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The free WalkSafe app, which offers safety alerts to women and became famous in the weeks after Sarah Everard's death on Clapham Common, has remained at number one in the App Store for 2 months. The app has now been downloaded more than 550,000 times. It displays crime locations and gives safety alerts when walking or exercising. I'm joined now by Emma Kay, co-founder of WalkSafe. Emma, it's great to have you back on the podcast because we talked to you right at the very beginning. I actually thought this is going to really take off, but my word, how well it's done. 550,000 times it's been downloaded, and that's rising every day.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having us back on. We're really excited to be here. Obviously, you know, it's double-sided, bittersweet. Obviously, we are really pleased that the app has been, you know, so successful. However, it was tainted with some tragic news about Sarah Everard, and, you know, it's really sad that our app even has to exist, and really takes tragic instances like this to really make everyone think about their personal safety. But yes, it has been a very, very good couple of months for downloads. Like you said, we're over 500,000. So, you know, we're doing well.
Just remind us, Emma, why you set it up.
So it basically stemmed from a conversation I had around the dinner table with my family, and we were talking about previous sort of like personal experiences and how mine, being a younger female, had definitely shaped my life and, you know, all the experiences I went through. I can't say that the men around the table could actually have, they empathised, but they didn't understand, and obviously they hadn't gone through it. So from that conversation, my brother-in-law and myself went away and we decided to come up with the app. We wanted to make it free, and yeah, that was kind of the sort of like idea behind it, was we just didn't want other people to keep feeling this way, and we wanted to do something about it.
And you've got the WalkSafe map, which shows reports of crime taken from monthly crime police reports in the area, including sexual assault, mugging, knife crime, pickpocketing, crime icons designed to help people see patterns and trouble spots, and automatic alerts when people are near these crime hotspots. I think also, Emma, you've introduced a police-only icon. Just tell me what that's about, because I think that's new since we first spoke to you.
So what we've done is we've listened to our user feedback, and we've definitely made our community posting versus our police posting very different. So like you touched on earlier, if you're walking down the street, you'd get a police verified notification. And when you look at your interactive WalkSafe map, all of the crime data you see, that is 100% police reported data. And what we've done then is we've separated our community posting icon. So that is where you or I could be walking down the road and spot there are no streetlights. So that is something we could input onto the map. It does have a shelf life depending on what icon you press. So for instance, streetlight, that will be up on our map for 6 hours. So what we've done is we've really made it very clear to our users, which is, you know, completely verified police data versus what is something that our WalkSafe user could input themselves.
Very good. And you've got this terrific Home Safe feature, which allows the user to set their estimated time of arrival home and will send their location to emergency contacts if they don't get back, if they don't complete that journey on time. I imagine that's become very useful too.
Oh, it has. And I think now more than ever, you know, now lockdown is easing, people are going back out again, people are, you know, meeting friends. You know, parents are letting their teenagers go back out. You know, those are the sorts of times now that people will be using the Home Safe feature. So, yes, I definitely think it's been very popular again.
And I think this is unique. Is there anything quite like this anywhere in the rest of Europe?
So there have been other apps. I can't say that they've got what we've got, and that is we have got completely 100% police verified data on our side. So that is where we're very different. They may offer similar safety features, but I think that really stands us out in the crowd because ultimately, you know, we're providing that knowledge for people to go out and make safer choices and have that awareness of those danger spots within their area.
Absolutely. And Emma, people listening, if they don't know how to find the app, it's WalkSafe. Do they go into the App Store or do they just Google WalkSafe? How do they find you?
So you can find us on the App Store, exactly right. Just punch in WalkSafe. And we are on Google Play as well. And we also have a website. So if you put our name into Google, you can, find more from there.
Well, the very best of luck, Emma. You're doing a brilliant job. And thanks so much for coming on. When you reach a million, and I know you will, we're going to get you back.
Can't wait. Thank
you
for having
me. All right, Emma. We'll look forward to it. That's Emma Kay, the co-founder of WalkSafe. Prince William and the Duchess of Cambridge, they've launched their very own YouTube channel this week with a video which shows the couple's cooler side. The couple released a 25-second video featuring brief highlights of their royal duties. The channel gained 226,000 followers in just a day and comes as Meghan and Harry, of course, are raking in millions from deals with firms such as Netflix. I'm joined now by Victoria Murphy, royal author and writer for Town & Country. Victoria, you've had a look at it. It's going to become a hugely popular channel, isn't it?
I mean, certainly it already is. There's no doubt that there's a lot of appetite still, despite the fact that they've been in the public eye for 10 years for the Cambridges. People are still very interested in what they're doing. And I think behind the scenes stuff is of particular interest. And I think they've always been fairly guarded, you know, over the years about what they've put out there in the public domain. I think William once said, you know, once you put something out, you can't take it back. And I think they have been careful to not give away too much of their personal life. But I think we are getting a little bit more of a glimpse with some of these videos. The first video they posted are sort of some outtakes, kind of giving you a view into how they interact with each other, how they speak to each other behind the scenes. And those things, I think, are going to be very, very popular with the public.
Yeah, and do you think we'll see little of the children in the YouTube channel, Victoria? Because, of course, they very jealously guard the privacy of their children. The photographs are normally released by the Cambridges, often taken by Kate herself.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's a good point because, you know, so much is made of the Sussexes very fiercely guarding their private life. But, you know, make no mistake, the Cambridges are the same. And William and Kate have always been from the beginning very clear that when it comes to their children's lives in day-to-day life, that is absolutely off limits. And they have been happy to share pictures of the children, but as long as they can control it. And I think that's the key. And what they're doing with social media is something that they've been doing for many years now on Instagram and on Twitter is they are packaging up content and having complete control over how that content is produced and what we see. So we're looking at sort of outtakes, but at the same time, you know, they're outtakes that they're clearly happy for us to see and to know about. I think we will see the children, I think, in the same way that we do on their other social media channels. I would imagine that if they are going to put something out, it will now also go on their YouTube channel as well. We've obviously seen over the past year quite a lot, actually, comparatively, of the Cambridge kids. I think that's been down a bit to lockdown. I think perhaps down to the fact that they appreciate that, by and large, they are very much left alone now in their day-to-day life. Would we be getting as many images if, for example, there were unsolicited pictures of the Cambridges turning up in places? So I think that they appreciate and understand the interest, and they're happy to share, but having that control remains very important to them.
I've got to ask you this. Do you suspect, is there any element of one-upmanship here with Harry and Meghan, who have to ply their trade too on social media, of course?
Well, I'm not surprised you're asking. You know, given the fact that they've joined YouTube now, it's been around for a long time, obviously. But I think, you know, this isn't a divergence from too much from what we've seen the Cambridges do already with social media. And I think if anyone thinks we're going to start seeing them in a completely different guise, I think that's perhaps wishful thinking. I think it's going to be very in line with how we see them present themselves already to the world. And Harry and Meghan, at the minute, they don't have social media. So, of course, they are the royals that initially, I think, people have always thought of as being on social media. Meghan was on it before she met Harry, but they actually have no social media at the moment at all themselves.
Right. I wonder if that will change now. Maybe they'll set up their own YouTube channel. Bit of one-upmanship with the Cambridges.
Well, we'll have to see.
Absolutely. That's Victoria Murray. She's a royal author, of course, and she's a writer for Town and Country. Thanks so much for joining us. Now, if you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MelPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So it's now time for our regular City Update with Ruth Sunderland, who, of course, is the business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth, fascinating, as we're getting closer to lifting of more lockdown measures, yet 50 of our firms are not planning to get staff back into the office full time ever, ever, ever.
Yeah, so they say. I do feel this is a question of wait and see. And my personal feeling is that the new normal in a few months or maybe a year or so's time might resemble the old normal rather more than people suspect at this juncture. But yes, this is a survey done of 50 of the UK's biggest employers. And of those, 43 of them said that they wanted to do a mixture of home and office working and have staff working from home 2 or 3 days a week. So, you know, this is quite interesting. I mean, these are firms like WPP, the huge giant advertising firm. So they're big name people. The attraction, I think, from a corporate point of view, is that if you've got people working from home part of the week, you might be able to make big savings on office space, which sounds tempting. Of course, you might not necessarily be able to achieve that if everybody wants to take Monday and Friday off and you've got a full house Tuesday to Thursday. So it might not be quite as simple as it sounds. My worry about this, Andrew, I don't know what you think, is that I think if it dawns on companies that actually, you know, people don't need to be in the office to do their job and they can be, you know, at home in wherever they've bought a lovely house in Cornwall or somewhere, well, why not go to Bangalore or go somewhere where you can employ people at a fraction of the cost?
So very good point.
I do, you know, I do think there's something to be said for being in the office and that creativity and being seen.
I agree. I think you get more out of people. You and I have been into conferences on Zoom, Ruth, and they're not as productive or constructive as a meeting with 12 people in a room. They're just not.
They're absolutely not. And the other issue with all of this is that our broadband is not necessarily good enough. So working remotely is fine as long as your technology is really robust and you've got great connectivity. And frankly, you know, lots of places in the UK don't really have that, including black spots in central London. You know, I quite often lose my broadband in Clapham, which is ridiculous, let alone if you were somewhere quite remote. So I think if we're going to do this, we're going to need, you know, BT and Openreach to step up more, and we're going to have to have far better broadband in more places. But I think there's nothing like that human contact. And we shouldn't forget as well, this could create a bit of a two-tier situation where people in nice middle-class jobs who've got nice houses are able to work at home, but they can only do that because other people are delivering their their food and their goods to them and don't have that option. You know, we could end up with a bit of workplace apartheid going on, which is not really desirable.
No, and I tell you one thing, Ruth, if you wander around Whitehall, like I still often do as part of the job, it is deserted. So civil servants, I suspect, are going to be almost the last, if any, to go back. They clearly are. And I think if the government wants people to go back to work, they've got to lead by example and tell some of those civil servants to get back to their desk pronto.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think the government has to lead by example. I think the civil servants do need to get back. They're also the what economists call, you know, the externalities of all of this, aren't there? That if people are working from home, then they're not going into town centres and spending money. So it has some knock-on effects that, you know, and not... They're indirect, really. But I also wonder as well, you know, if you've got people in important capacities not there on the spot, I think crises and scandals can easily run away from you. You know, the boss of AstraZeneca, for example, is in Australia under lockdown with his family. Now, I can't help but wondering, if he'd been on the spot, would the row in the EU around the vaccine from AstraZeneca, would that have got such traction if he'd been there on the ground to deal with it? You know, you don't know the answer, but the suspicion is it sends a message if you're not there.
Absolutely. I'm with you as one. That's Ruth Sundon, who is, of course, business editor of the Daily Mail. Nobody will forget that ad. Nick Kamen appearing in a very racy Levi ad filmed in a laundrette. There he was in his boxer shorts with several women looking on. One of them who was looking on, the Mail on Sunday's Liz Jones. She went further. She wasn't content to swoon over the ad. She even arranged a meeting, and she joins me now because, of course, Nick Kamen died tragically at the age of 59 this week. Liz, first of all, I must ask you, are you completely heartbroken?
Well, it came as such a shock.
Yeah.
Because we only lost his brother in 2015, and Barry was just as handsome as Nick.
Mm.
He was a model and a painter, and he died when he was 52. So we've only just got over Barry dying, and now we've lost Nick Kamen. And I've been playing Marvin Gaye today as a bit of an homage to him.
Yeah. It was, I heard it through the grapevine with the ad, wasn't it?
If you were that generation,
yeah.
You know, I was in my 20s when the ad came out in 1985. We were very, very into feminism then, and we wanted men not to be these great butch, hairy men. We wanted someone who was a bit of a man-child. He was completely hairless, and he did his own washing.
Yes.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it took quite a long time for you to actually to get that meeting set up with Nick and his younger brother, Barry.
Yeah, well, I was a journalist at the time. I was on a woman's magazine called Company. And it took 5 years to get my interview with Nick and his brother. And I eventually got it through his publicist because then he became a pop star.
Yeah.
And his publicist, he shared a publicist with Madonna, who was also quite keen on him. So Madonna and I were love rivals.
Yes.
And I went to the publicist's office and interviewed Nick and Barry, and they were just such nice boys. They were just Essex boys, because I'm an Essex girl.
Yeah.
They're very working class, very down to earth. He sort of couldn't believe he was this pin-up, because they were mixed race, and in those days, mixed race boys didn't see themselves as pin-ups.
No.
So he was one of the first dark-skinned men to sort of cross over, and we all just loved him.
Yeah. And you wrote your piece, I'm sure he loved it, but sadly, Liz, he never got in touch with you again.
No, well, this always happens, you see. You always go and interview a superstar. So, you know, I've interviewed Bruce Willis and Antonio Banderas, and they never contact you afterwards.
No. Were you disappointed?
I was quite disappointed, but I kept buying the Face magazine because they both modelled in the Face.
Yeah, yeah.
Very regularly, and they were part of a movement called the Buffalo Movement, with a stylist called Ray Petrie, and he put them into skirts.
Oh.
And so we still fancied Nick Kamen and Barry Kamen, even though they wore skirts, and they wore lipstick as well. So they wore makeup, and it was very early on for men to wear makeup as well. So he was really quite a groundbreaking chap.
Yeah, and this extraordinary story you tell in your piece, Liz, the weirdest thing, October 2015, you have a dream that Barry comes to your house, very vivid dream. Tell us what you did next.
Yeah, I mean, I had this very vivid dream that he came to my house, he met my horses, and I hadn't thought about Barry Cayman for 30 years, hadn't thought about him. And it stayed with me when I got up the next day that he'd come to my house. I thought, well, how amazing that Barry Cayman came to my house in my dream. And then I went to my phone, I went on Twitter, and I found out he died. So I'd have this premonition that he died.
How sad and terrible is that? And now Nick's gone too. Was he still working as a model at the end, Liz? What, he appeared to have disappeared below the radar a bit.
I think he wasn't working as a model, but he was always very into music. So even when he got the job in the laundrette, in the Levi's ad, he really wanted to be a musician. He didn't really want to be a model, same as Barry didn't want to be a model. He wanted to be a famous artist. So I think Nick was still playing and doing little gigs and playing his guitar and everything, but he'd been ill for quite some time.
Very sad. You wrote a lovely piece, Liz, and I'm very sorry because I have to say, I had a bit of a crush on him myself. Am I allowed
That's
to say
fantastic.
That?
Yeah.
That's Liz Jones, the fabulous Mail on Sunday writer and columnist. Thanks for joining us. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'm going to be back with you tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.